So I'm going to go ahead and jump into a teaching on Hanukkah, probably a series. Yeah, I kind of feel a series coming on. So it is the season, so why not? So I've entitled this first one, The Inspiration of Hanukkah. Hanukkah is very inspirational. It's full of revelation. The very symbol of Hanukkah is light. Speaking of revelation. So Hanukkah, though, has been overlooked by the traditional Gentile church for nearly 2,000 years. In fact, the average Christian doesn't have a clue as to what Hanukkah is or where it's found in the Bible. It has been neglected, and its importance has been undermined as a result. And what we've lost is this idea that Hanukkah is not only central to the Messiah, he is inextricably connected with it. His mission, his life, his purpose, it's connected to this ancient celebration of Hanukkah. One cannot separate the meaning of Hanukkah from who Jesus is. Now, I know that some of you might be saying that's a little bit of a stretch. You know, you're kind of exaggerating, aren't you, Pastor? Promise, I'm not. Hang with me. I'll show you. I'll demonstrate this. Jesus is the inaugural fulfillment of the revelation and significance of Hanukkah. The themes and the lessons are universal and life-changing, and we celebrate it because it inspires us to believe in Jesus and to stay loyal to the law of God. So join us in our dance with this ancient song and story of Hanukkah. Like Jesus said, you shall know the truth, and the truth will set you free. So let's answer the biggest question. Where's Hanukkah in the New Testament? If this is such a big festival, if this is so important, where is it in the New Testament? Thanks for asking. John chapter 10, verses 22 through 23. Now I know for many of you, this is like, you know what, preaching to the choir. But the choir needs to hear it over and over and over. Right? Why do we read the Torah on a cycle annually? Because we forget things along the way. We read these stories over and over. These lessons are learned over and over so we can implement them over and over and stay in the centrality of who Jesus is and how we're to live our lives for his glory. For those that are new, though, John chapter 10, verses 22 through 23 says, at that time, the Feast of Dedication took place at Jerusalem. It was winter, and Jesus was walking in the temple in the colonnade of Solomon. Keep that slide up for just a moment. At that time, the Feast of Dedication took place in Jerusalem. That's Hanukkah. The Festival of Dedication is, in fact, the translation of the Hebrew word Hanukkah. Hanukkah in Hebrew means dedication. The festival of dedication is the festival of Hanukkah. It's all about dedicating ourselves to the Messiah and the commandments of God. Many will say, though, this doesn't mean anything other than Jesus just happened to be in the temple when Hanukkah was occurring. It doesn't mean that he was intending to keep it. There's no indications that he's there because of the celebration. He's in the temple quite often. He's just there. And it's a coincidence that it's the festival of Hanukkah. Really? Let's take a closer look. Where's the ministry base of Yeshua? Galilee. Where is Galilee in relationship to the land of Israel? Oh, it's the north. It's the north. If we were to say Colorado is like the land of Israel, Galilee would be like Fort Collins, right? Denver would be like Jerusalem. So you have Jesus' home base of ministry way up north in Galilee. That's where he ministers. That's where he started his ministry. It's the base of operations. That's where he moves and ministers most of the time. In fact, they refer to him as Jesus the Galilean, because that's where he ministers. No, he comes down to Jerusalem for the three pilgrimage feasts. According to the law of Moses, all the males have to come down to Jerusalem for those festivals. And he does. He makes his way down to Jerusalem for the three pilgrimage festivals, but he always returns to Galilee. That's his home base of operations. So think about this for a minute. Passover, Shavuot, and Sukkot. Outside of that, he's basically up in Galilee. Hanukkah is not one of those pilgrimage feasts. It's not commanded for all the Israelite men to show up. It's post-Mosaic. Very important. It's a national holy day, if you will, not so much a Mosaic. Very important to the Jewish people, but not mandated by God that everyone has to come down to Jerusalem. It's optional. Plus, Hanukkah occurs when? In the winter. Corresponding to our December, month of December. It's the winter time in the land. And it gets really, really cold, and it's the rainy season. Think about that for a moment. Jesus is down here at a festival that's not even required to be at. Why isn't he up in Galilee? Why is it important for him to be down here in Jerusalem at this festival? You think he jumped on an Uber to get there, by the way, right? No, think about this. The distance between Nazareth, his hometown in Galilee, and Jerusalem is approximately 90 miles. And guess how people typically traveled back in the day? They walked. Unless you were fairly wealthy and had a donkey, right? Or maybe a caravan. Yeah, Jesus didn't have a lot of money. We know that. Him and his disciples probably walked as they came down to the pilgrimage festivals like so many others. But this one's not even required. And if Jesus was to make his way down, traveling on foot, 90 miles, it would take him about 30 hours to get there. 30 hours. Now, if you're walking 8 hours a day, which is a lot of walking, it would take you 3, maybe 4 days to walk from Nazareth to Jerusalem. That's quite a walk. I walk every day. My wife and I, we walk every day, 1 to 2 miles every day. I'm exhausted. I can't imagine walking 90 miles. You know, that's a hard walk. It's not like they had Adidas back then either. 3 to 4 days, walking 8 hours a day. That's how long it would take. Now you add to that, it's winter. It's the rainy season and it's cold. Most scholars say in the winter, to travel on foot is going to be 4 to 5 days because of the weather, the season that you're in. Yeah, that's a long walk. I think if Jesus wanted to be there, it was probably super important to him, because that's a pretty big sacrifice to make in order to get there. Now, other scholars suggest that he probably just stayed in Jerusalem because of the distance. It's already entering the winter months at Sukkot. That's your fall/winter season. So since he was already in Jerusalem during Sukkot, he probably just hung out in Jerusalem until Hanukkah. That makes sense, right? I think so. Guess what, though? There's 10 weeks between Sukkot and Hanukkah. Do you imagine the costs of staying somewhere for 10 weeks in order to be at the festival? And that's going to be a sacrifice as well. When you factor in what it takes to stay in some other location other than your own home base, that costs money to do that. You have to put people out to do that. Either way you slice it, for Jesus to be in the temple or in Jerusalem during Hanukkah would have been a great sacrifice on his part. This idea that it was some kind of coincidence doesn't wash when you take a deeper look at the historical and cultural backdrop to this passage. Big sacrifice. It was important to Jesus. He wanted to be there. And why? Well, that's part of the revelation of the festival. Keep in mind that the festival, by the first century, became known as the Festival of Light. It was called the Festival of Hanukkah for quite some time, decades. But by the time you get to the first century, it shifts. And the name that becomes most popular is the Festival of Light, rather than the Festival of Hanukkah. And there's a number of reasons why that took a shift in terms of name that I don't have time to go into at this point. Suffice it to say, that was the most popular title given to the festival by the first century. One of the reasons is that the symbol of Hanukkah is light. The Hanukkah, the menorah, right? It is lit up during this time every day for 8 days. The holiday is symbolized by light. And light is a metaphor in the Hebrew scriptures for illumination and revelation, right? When you finally understand something you couldn't understand forever, what do you say? Wow, it's like the light went on. Yeah, you caught the illumination. You understood the concept. It's like coming into a room and it's pitch black. You don't even know what's in it. Turn on the light, you know everything that's in the room. The light reveals what's in the room. This is the festival of revelation. The Jewish people understood this is the festival of illumination, that God is the one that illuminates our minds and our hearts so that we can understand what is true. This is the festival of light. Josephus says that during the festival of Hanukkah, they made these huge, huge candelabras, Hanukkiahs. They had 8 total candles, if you will. But what they were is they were giant. I forget how tall they were. They were like 10 feet tall. They're just huge. And the candles, the wicks were made out of some of the old linens of the priests that they soaked in oil that they fixed up in these containers on top of these huge stands, right, these Hanukkiahs, and they lit them up on the 4 walls of the temple on the inside. They said it was so bright, it was so light, there was so much light in the temple. They said the whole city was aglow. You could for miles around see the city of Jerusalem glowing with the light of everyone's Hanukkiahs, everyone's lights that they had lit for this celebration of the Festival of Light. Why? Because it's the season, the Festival of Light. And Jesus was right there, right on time, walking in the temple in the midst of this light. It's crucial for him to be there. We'll see that as we get into this teaching on the festival. Before we get there, I want to back the train up and come back to the earlier times which gave the occasion and the rise for the birth of this great festival. This is the theological backdrop to Hanukkah. It's found in Daniel chapter 8. Daniel the prophet gives a prophecy of the Greeks, the coming Greek Empire, and how it would deceive, invade, and destroy the temple and institute pagan culture, pagan practice, and a pagan form of government in Israel. Their leader Antiochus Epiphanes. Boo. Like Haman. It's like Haman, right? All the festivals are summed up in this saying. They attacked us, we won, let's eat. So their leader, Antiochus Epiphanes, he would play the role of an antichrist. He would ban the observance of the commandments of God. This is the agenda, which is also the reoccurring agenda of all antichrists. They are all about the spirit of lawlessness, the mystery of lawlessness. Law being a reference to the Torah, not civil law. Less and less Torah. It is the elimination of the Torah that is the agenda of the Antichrist, to draw people away from the ways of God, away from the commandments of God, to a different way of living. A different way of living that's based on falsehoods, deception, pain, and misery. Antiochus, he shows up right on time, according to the prophecy of Daniel. And he does exactly what Daniel said he would do. In fact, I want to read part of that in the first book of Maccabees, chapter 1, verses 41 through 53. Let me just kind of work down through that. It says, the king, Antiochus Epiphanes, then issued a proclamation to his whole kingdom that all were to become a single people, each nation renouncing its particular customs. Verse 42. All the Gentiles conformed to the king's decree, and many Israelites, that's slide 21. All the Gentiles conformed to the king's decree, and many Israelites chose to accept his religion. Isn't that interesting? His religion. Sacrificing to idols and profaning the Sabbath. Profaning the Sabbath. Profaning the mark of God on all who believe in him that identifies them with him and him with them. This is the mark of God. We read that both in the Torah and in the prophets, that the Sabbath is a sign between God and his people. When you talk about the metaphor of the covenant as marriage, the Sabbath is the wedding ring. It's a sign of their marriage, of their union. Sabbath is very important. It's one of the things that King Antiochus banned. The king also set edicts by messengers to Jerusalem and the towns of Judah, directing them to adopt customs foreign to the country, banning burnt offerings, sacrifices, and libations from the sanctuary, profaning Sabbaths and feasts, defiling the sanctuary and everything that is holy, building altars, shrines, and temples for idols, sacrificing pigs and unclean beasts, leaving their sons uncircumcised and prostituting themselves to all kinds of impurity and abomination. There's nothing new under the sun. 2020, our civil leaders shut down our churches. They said, no more church. You can't observe the Sabbath. It's forbidden. Stay home. If you want to go somewhere, well, we have our churches, the local strip joint or liquor store. Can you believe that? That they kept those things open, sanctioned by their laws, and wrote laws that forbid us to gather together and observe the Sabbath. It's unbelievable. It's never a surprise. It's what we always see down through history. Now, this was a much more focused and greater crisis in the days of the Maccabees, certainly, right? But in verse 49, it says that the goal of the Antichrist, the reason he did these things, was so that they should forget the law and revoke all observance of it. Yeah, the spirit of lawlessness, the mystery of lawlessness, the work of the Antichrist is to cause people to fall away from the ways of God, fall away from the commandments of God. It is the mystery of lawlessness. Verse 50, anyone who refused to obey the command of the king was to be put to death. Wow. Wow. We've experienced some persecution in the United States over the last, 10 years, 4 or 5 years for sure. Even some persecution. Nothing in comparison to what our ancient ancestors experienced in the days of the Maccabees. But it's also true that in many places throughout our world, believers are put to death because of their faith in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Because they're walking in the ways of God, they are singled out for even death. If we jumped into the future, into the final crisis that's still coming, we're going to discover that there's nothing new there. It's a replay of what we've already seen. In fact, let me just jump there, Revelation 13, and read this. It says, then I saw another beast, this one rising up out of the earth. It had two horns like those of a lamb, but it spoke like a dragon. It wielded all authority of the first beast on its behalf, and it forced the earth and all its inhabitants to worship the first beast, whose mortal wound had been healed. It performed great signs, even making fire come down from heaven to earth in the sight of all. By the signs it was allowed to perform on behalf of the beast, it deceived the inhabitants of the earth, persuading them to erect an image for the beast that had been wounded by the sword and yet lived. Antiochus Epiphanes, he banned true faith, true religion, and instituted his own, which was marked by idolatry, and the people were forced to bow and to worship the civil king as the Messiah. That doesn't change. It's coming again. Revelation 13:15. It was permitted to give life to the beast's image so that it could even speak and cause all those to be put to death who would not worship the image of the beast. That's still coming. Why do we have these other stories? Why do we have these other celebrations? Because they inform us that it's already come multiple times in the past. That it comes again is a given. That there's a final crisis is true. But there's no surprise here. We have all the stories. And with those stories and lessons, the courage and the faith to stand up against it and say, no, you can take my life. Actually, autocorrect. You can take my body. You can't touch my soul. Yeah, you can only kill my body. I'm going to rise again and judge you and determine your punishments and then mock you when the angels drag you off to the lake of fire. Yeah. So you know what? We win no matter what. Even martyrdom is a promotion. But I'm not counting on martyrdom. I'm not going to go like a lamb to the slaughter. That's Jesus. I'm not Jesus. I don't have that level of character. I'm not a martyr. Now I'm going to swing my sword and try to take the head of the dragon off, just like Lord of the Rings or The Hobbit. Yeah, we're called to rise up and fight evil. We're going to overcome it one way or another. Even martyrdom is part of the way that we overcome. This is the story of Hanukkah. The few overcoming the many. It also forced all the people, both small and great, both rich and poor, both free and slave, to be branded on the right hand and on the forehead. Branded on the right hand and the forehead. No one could buy or sell anything except one who has been branded with the name of the beast or with the number of his name. We can see a level of fulfillment coming that's much greater than we've ever seen in the past because we're going digital globally. Right now, People are being debanked. Have you heard about being debanked? That's where the bank debanks you. It's like being censored economically. It's where your bank says, oh, here's all your savings or whatever. Now go away. No credit cards, no checks. All you got is cash. That's all you got, which means if you're a business owner, you're dead in your tracks economically. You can't buy, sell, or trade. Very, very difficult to do that. And who do you appeal to? The courts? The courts don't even have jurisdiction over that. There's no laws concerning that. There's no courts. There's no way to adjudicate that. It's just the raw power of the bank to say, debanked. And of course, they're always working with big government, because big government and big banks, they always work together. It's called fascism. Yeah, this is what we're reading about in Revelation. If you don't bow to what I say to bow to, you can't buy, sell, or trade. You push back hard enough, we'll take your heads off. Yeah, that's the beast system. That's the beast system. Who's afraid of the big bad beast? We are not to be afraid. Fear not, our God's much greater. Everything's going to be okay. Martyrdom is for the few, not the many. So chances are you and I are not going to be martyred, right? Just thrown in prison and starved to death. No, I'm joking. That is, yeah. The point is this. With the Lord, we shall overcome. Okay. So the Maccabees, they rise up, they say no to the king, and they said, we're not going to compromise in our loyalty to the commandments of God. And so that war breaks out, and they fight a guerrilla-style war against the superpower of the day. This is a superpower. This is a world empire. And these few inspire so much courage that many, many others in Israel flee to the mountains to join in the resistance against the beast of their day. And God intervenes, and through his providence, he gives them victory after victory after victory until they finally overthrow the superpower of the day. Bam. I know they're not teaching much history anymore in our school system. It would be really good to revisit 1776 and the Great Revolutionary War and how just a few farmers, basically from the colonies, overthrow the superpower of the day, Great Britain. It's not possible. It's not possible. When you read the history of that war, you see the providence of God and how he gave us what we needed to win victory after victory against all odds. Who would have thought, right? It's the providence of God. We are encouraged to take a stand against the beast, against evil, because God is with us and moves providentially among us. This is why we can have courage. So after this pagan civil king gets defeated and moved out, the Maccabees and many others come into Jerusalem to the temple area, and they clean it all up. They tear down the pagan altar. They take away all the stones. They completely, pretty much, start all over. They kind of rebuild it, if you will. And they then light the menorah. And then they dedicate the holy place back to God, and they dedicate their lives to the law of God. They come back and they say, God, we believe in you. We thank you. You gave us victory. You gave us victory. And for that, we dedicate our lives to you forever. We will love and serve you and walk in your ways because you have delivered us from the beast system. So that's what they did. 2 Maccabees chapter 10, 5 through 8. The purification of the temple took place on the very same day on which the temple had been profaned by the Gentiles. That is the 25th day of the same month, Chislev. He set up the idol of himself in the month of Chislev, which corresponds to our month, December. The Antichrist of Greece sets up the idol to himself, commanding people to worship him, had a pig slaughtered on it, on what equates to, generally speaking, December 25th. And then 3 years later, on December 25th, they clean it all back up and dedicate it back. I don't even want to talk about dates. Read between the lines. 2 Maccabees 10:6. And we do celebrate the birth of Jesus. We love the birth of Jesus. We do a big celebration of the birth of Jesus all week long during Sukkot, which is the theological setting for the birth of Jesus. We're not anti-celebrating the birth of Jesus. 2 Maccabees 10:6, the celebration and rejoicing lasted for 8 days in the manner of the Feast of Booths, as they recalled how only a short time before, during the Feast of Booths, they had been living like wild animals in the mountains and the caves. So they instituted an 8-day celebration to mark this deliverance of God and their dedication to him. 8 days, based on Sukkot being 8 days. And the symbol they chose for Hanukkah was the light of the menorah. They made 8-branched candelabras. We have a 7-branch. That's like the temple. Temple has 7. The Hanukkah has 9. It's actually 9. 1 is a serving candle, and then 8 candles for 8 days. And that became the symbol of Hanukkah. And then the name was switched from Hanukkah to light, because light was the symbol of this celebration. Verse 8 of 2 Maccabees chapter 10. They also decreed by a public edict, ratified by vote. I love that. I just love that. That Israel has kind of the first constitutional republic. Back in the days of Moses and being refined, separating civil from religious spheres, right? Separation of church and state. I mean, we have our whole constitutional republic is based on what was given to Moses and refined down through the years. But anyway, public decree ratified by a vote that the whole Jewish nation should observe these days every year. So again, there's nothing new under the sun. Revelation 12:17. Then the dragon became furious with the woman and went off to make war with the rest of her offspring on those who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus. The ultimate Antichrist attacks Israel and the Gentile followers of Jesus, implementing the same plan of this Greek Antichrist. And the message to all of us is the same as it was back then. Stay faithful. No compromise. Be loyal to our King and our King's law. Revelation 14:12 puts it this way. Here's a call for endurance. Here's a call to remain courageous. These are speaking of the saints who keep the commandments of God and their faith in Jesus. Do not fear. Fight, fight, fight. I'm so inspired. You know, I'm so inspired. They shot him and it grazed his head. He fell to the ground. And then they wanted to take him out on a gurney. He refuses, says, no, I'm getting up. I'm getting up. They're, stay down. It's Rocky Balboa in the 12th round. His fight manager, stay down, you know. He gets up at the risk of his life because this was an assassination plot. Who knows what's still in place? What's still in play? He doesn't care. He gets up. Raises his head, fight, fight, fight. I want to say this. We need to stay true to Jesus. Stay proud of him, true to him, in love with him. Make him first in our lives. And then walk in his ways. No matter the pushback, no matter what happens, no matter how hard they swing, it doesn't matter what they throw at us, we're going to stand up and fight, fight, fight. He is the Savior of the world. And we have his light in us. And we're to be the light of the world. And we say to the evil that encroaches, get out of our way. We're bringing the love of God through Jesus to everyone we meet. It's our legacy. It's our mission. And nothing is going to stop us. Nothing is going to stop us. All right. Shabbat shalom. That's it. That's part one. We'll get to part two and three and four, whatever, but it's going to be a great series. So thank you again. Shabbat shalom.